This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest today is Dr. Tim Spector. Dr. Spector is a professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College in London. And he is also the scientific co-founder of Zoe, which is a new instrument, very exciting, which is designed to help personalize nutritional recommendations. Do I have that right, Dr. Spector?
Yes, that's right. It's personalized nutrition.
Okay, and that is available now to people in the U.S. as well via the website. That's
yes.
What is it called?
The website, it says joinzoe.com, joinzoe.com. And you can get the product now and test yourself and get your own food scores by looking at blood sugar levels, your fat levels, and a really in-depth sequence of your gut microbes.
Right, and this is I'm pretty sure that Zoe is going to be even more sophisticated in coming years because it's an ongoing research project that's informed by artificial intelligence, and you know there's strength in numbers. The more people who get involved with it, the more fine tuned it'll get in terms of refining the recommendations. So it's really a commendable effort. I congratulate you on that. Okay, the book, The Diet Myth, was your previous book. What was the main thrust there? Is it a book that pushes back against the notion that there's, you know, a one size fits all diet?
Well, I wrote that about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was before really I got into this personalized approach before we'd done the studies of the twins, giving them the identical foods. So I hadn't gone as much down that road. It was more to introduce the gut microbes to people and to, in each of the chapters, introduce how the gut microbes could influence our myths about diets and foods, about, you know, why diets were failing and how a lot of our lifestyles, you know, such as using antibiotics, and having over-sterile lifestyles could affect our gut microbes in ways we hadn't thought about. So it was really an introduction. For many people, there hadn't been many books on the gut microbes at that time written by scientists. And so it helped me do it as well. I must say, I went away and for 6 months and wrote it and sort of became an expert after writing it, not before it. So it was very helpful for me. And of course, it is just that area, rather than being a fad, which many people thought it was about 10 years ago, has just continued to grow and grow. And suddenly, you know, nearly everyone is talking about it. Although, unfortunately, most, as you know, most medics know very little about it. They see it as still a bit alternative. But I think it's something that everyone is going to have to know about it. It's like learning you've got a new organ in your body. Mm-hmm. And it's like discovering we had a second liver because it's just a full of trillions of chemical factories all pumping out fantastic chemical compounds that, you know, affect your brain, your immune system, your gut, your mood, appetite, everything. So it's a real treasure trove, and it just, that field just gets more exciting every year.
Indeed. So coming back to some of the myths that you tackle in Spoon-Fed, why almost everything we've been told about food is wrong, you talk about sodium. We're all encouraged to go on a low-salt diet, but is there room for individual variation on that?
Yeah, salt was an interesting one because 5 years ago I thought there's nothing to write about. It's obvious. You should just, you know, if you've got hypertension or you've got some health problem, you should just cut down on salt. But some recent studies in the last 3-4 years have really turned that on its head. They've shown that these tough salt restrictions that the American Heart Society and others have proposed actually can cause more problems than they save. And it sounds like, you know, we weren't designed to be salt restricted for long times. And I worked out that the average benefit the average, you know, middle-aged person who with hypertension going on a salt restricted diet would be to improve their blood pressure by about 1%, about 1 millimeter or so, which, given that it makes all your food tasteless and revolting for the rest of your life, to me, just seemed to be the wrong advice to be giving people. And we should be selecting those few, and I think there are about 10% of us
sensitive individuals, yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. But there are other 90% of us shouldn't necessarily have to be punished for that 10%. So that, and there's actually plenty of studies now from third world countries showing that salt restriction actually increases heart disease and that high salt intakes are associated with less disease. So I think the whole field has really changed from this dogma that, again, comes back to this oversimplification that we just take one thing, one chemical, and say that's bad, and that we don't care about what else, you know, you're having instead. So I totally changed my opinion after my doing my research on it. I don't know what your views are on salt.
No, I agree. And I mean, I've seen the research, I think some of the same research that you're talking about, research that suggests that there may be some rebound homeostasis that the body is trying to achieve that may actually cause some vasoconstriction, clamping down of the blood vessels when there's not enough sodium in the diet, which, you know, can ultimately cause hypertension, kind of a low-sodium version of hypertension. So, yes, I mean, individuals may, you know, on a case-by-case basis, need salt restriction. But overall, as a population-wide recommendation, you know, another one-size-fits-all recommendation that just doesn't stack up. You also talk about exercise. And a lot of people believe that, you know, even if their diet's not so good, they can atone for it in the gym. You know, they can just bang it out on the Peloton or, you know, on the treadmill. And, you know, they can run away from a bad diet. And you take that one on in your book.
Yeah, that's not a very popular one because no one likes to knock exercise. And I exercise every day. I cycle a lot. And I'd like to think it's helping my weight. But all the data shows it's not, and that you can't really run off a bad diet. And, I mean, obviously, if you're a semi-professional sportsman and you're doing hours a day, it's different. But for most of us, you know, doing half an hour of exercise 3 to 5 times a week, there's no evidence it helps you lose weight, and it gives you a false sense of security that, you know, you can have
that
moral
extra. I think the term that sometimes uses moral license. It gives you moral yeah, license to
exactly. You know, suddenly that beer afterwards, you know, and the nachos, you know, they don't seem as deadly. And so part of it might be the fact you just overeat because you think you've been such a good guy or girl. But also our bodies compensate. And so our bodies reduce our metabolic rate after exercise over the next 24 hours. So this really compensates. And so that's why it's really tough to depend on exercise for your weight. You really need to do both together to be of any use. And it's, you know, exercise is great for the heart and the best of the body and virtually every disease we know of. But I think we've got the wrong idea that it's a good way to lose weight.
Another myth that you tackle is coffee and caffeine, because some of my patients, you know, when I take a diet history, you know, they sort of guiltily confess that, I drink a couple of cups of coffee a day. I'm trying to kick the coffee, but yeah, I know it's bad for me, but I still have a little bit of it. But in the book, you say that that may not be another one size fits all recommendation.
Yes, there are not many hard trials, but all the epidemiology is now in the last 5 years is pointing that coffee drinking is beneficial for the heart. And you'd think, oh, well, maybe it's very dose responsive, but up to 6 coffees a day, which is an enormous amount.
Wow.
So and exactly why it is, we've always assumed it's caffeine, but it could well be all the other hundreds of chemicals in coffee, which is a fermented coffee bean that has all kinds of defense chemicals in it, so-called polyphenols, that are rocket fuel for your gut microbes. So my idea is that it's not such a – it doesn't have a direct effect on your blood vessels, which is the old way of thinking about things like coffee, but it actually helps your gut and – It's a source of fiber and all these polyphenols, and that's probably why it's good for you. And that seems to be why also decaf seems to be nearly as good as well. So if it's not too chemical, there seems to be evidence that as long as they keep most of the other compounds in coffee, you may do as well with decaf coffee. And that's disappointing for tea drinkers because they get upset. But say in England, there's lots of tea drinkers, but it's only the ones who drink green tea that seem to get the same benefits as coffee. And again, that suggests it's the polyphenols. So again, it's a different way of looking at food and health than most physicians have been used to.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this vital message with you. Are you looking to give your immune system a boost? This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a natural solution from Future Farm Botanicals, liquid wild oil of oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's wild oil of oregano supports a variety of health benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate wild oil of oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. Future Farm sources this product from the Mediterranean and produces it in the United States. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to today's guest, Dr. Tim Spector. In the book, you say that among the myths is that pesticides and herbicides, they've been tested. If they were really harmful, they wouldn't allow them to be introduced into our agriculture and into our food supply. But you push back on that notion.
Yes. I think, in a way, herbicides, pesticides, it's a bit like a new artificial sweetener in a diet drink. They get tested on lab rats to see if they get liver cancer when they're given massive doses. And that's how the FDA or the environment industry actually say these are safe, and they follow up these rats long term. But they don't really do any studies in humans, and they don't really do any studies in our gut microbes. And it's been shown that the commonest herbicide called Roundup, glyphosate, the commonest one in the world, does affect the genes of our microbes. So,
right, because I mean, it's something that actually, I mean, since it's anti, it kills, various types of microorganisms and that may affect plants. Should it not then affect the microorganisms in our gut?
Exactly. So it kills off plant microbes. It kills off. It attacks some of the genes of some of the weeds, and it also affects the soil, the microbes in the soil. And so it doesn't affect our genes. It doesn't affect our cells in our body, but it does affect our gut microbes. And I think this isn't an effect that, you know, you don't immediately get sick, but we are exposed to these things for, you know, the span of our lives now, 50 plus years. And so I am worried that these do cause problems, even if they're a smaller problem in millions of people. I don't think we've paid enough attention to that. And, you know, there are all these lawsuits in California going on saying it causes rare forms of lymphoma mm-hmm. in people who have been spraying it a lot, et cetera. And the epidemiology is still not clear on these particular cancers, but certainly Californian juries are paying out billions. So, right.
But short of causing cancer, it may have low-grade deleterious effects on the general populace, which are going to be hard to trace because, you know, cancer is a very discrete event, and especially rare cancers that shouldn't be happening. You know, you may say, oh, that person was a landscaper and they used to use, you know, gallons of the stuff. And, you know, you can see the smoking gun. But when the entire populace is exposed on a daily basis to small amounts of something, and the overall health of the populace is, shall we say, suboptimal. Yeah, potential problem.
So I'm worried about that. I'm particularly worried, you know, and you got pregnant women and young children who are more susceptible, that, you know, we just pass these chemicals as safe without really doing the tests. And I would like really a grassroots change in how we sign off these things. And you know, and the manufacturers who are generally in the food companies and the fertilizer business, you know, they're very rich. They could afford to do long-term studies, but they're not asked to. And I think that needs to change.
Well, you know, you're kind of a renaissance man because in addition to being an expert on genetics and the microbiome and on food, as well as a medical doctor, you're also working on a project to track COVID-19 in the UK via an app. And, you know, to tie those two things together, there's some interesting speculation that the severity of COVID-19 in a given individual, one determinant may be the composition of their microbiome. I'm pretty sure you're all over that.
Yes. You know, it became obvious that diet and COVID are linked because you just look at the risk factors of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and deprivation. Already that gives you some clues. And then you look at, you know, the fact that the US and the UK have the highest processed food rates and in the sort of Western world have suffered most in terms of deaths and things. It starts to stack up, and there's been studies of the gut microbes in people who've had COVID, and they are very badly affected. But there haven't been many studies yet of longitudinal studies looking to see, well, does the prior diet predispose you to COVID because of your microbiome? And we're halfway through these studies. We've got some data coming out in the next 2 weeks from a survey. So the amazing thing about this COVID app is we got 4.5 million people to download it, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
And this was basically converting the Zoe team doing the nutrition app to a COVID symptom app and getting lots of social media on it. So there's no governments or, you know, big companies behind it. And we still have 1 million people every day giving us data. And even, you know, nearly a year on. But we did a survey of 2 million people that they filled in a food frequency questionnaire for us. Imagine that, 2 million food frequency questionnaires. Wow. And we did it in like 2 weeks. We got the answer. You know, it would have cost $5-10 million and taken 3 years, you know, by conventional means. And with that, we've worked out that people on a poor diet that was poor for your gut health had a 50% increase in risk of COVID.
Wow.
Even when you adjust for all the other factors like obesity and deprivation. So obviously diet is crucial, and it's now more crucial than ever. And I think it's this link between the foods you eat, your gut microbes, and then your immune system. And we have to wake up that, you know, this is perhaps the most important part of our health to get right. And, you know, we can all these fancy medicines to treat it, but, you know, these kind of infections are going to be around for many years, and we need to start changing our societies really to stop this, you know, this malaise and having up such sick microbes that I think are causing problems. So, yeah, it's an exciting field, and, you know, hopefully by changing people's diets, by introducing, you know, selected probiotics, you know, and education, we can really change things.
Wow. I'd be very excited to receive a copy of that study once it's out, and, you know, I'll certainly get the word out to our, you know, via our social media and to our listeners, because that's just a momentous study. When it's, you know, there's probably an embargo, but I'd love to take a peek at it. Well, so if you can.
Yeah, well, we hope. Yeah, I mean, I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but we hope to submit a preprint in 2 weeks' time, and we're doing it with the group at Harvard, the School of Public Health. So it's a combined US UK effort, and we've got US people in there as well. So I think it's going to cause a bit of a stir, you know, and has big social ramifications about the idea that, you know, government's role is to keep food cheap at all costs, and encourage snacking and all these things that are seen
as, you know, effect to subsidize and encourage the food industry, you know, because there's certainly a lot of collusion between the government and the food industry, including in the United States. I don't know what it's like in the UK, but agricultural subsidies that make corn and wheat and soy and sugar ultra profitable and easily, you know, once they transmogrify it into a fast food or into a ultra processed food, something that's readily available.
No, absolutely. I mean, it all in the US, it all started as a part of, you know, to beat the Russians in the Cold War, to get food cheaper than the Russians could produce it. And it just got out of control, and now these small companies are now worth more than most 50% of the countries in the world. And our food's controlled by 10 companies, and they have huge lobbying power. And as you say, they keep these subsidies, which is, you know, it means they can't really stop doing what they're doing because it's just so profitable. And the people trying to sell fruits and vegetables have none of the same advantages, and that the gap between them gets larger every year. So relatively, bad food gets cheaper, and well, good food gets more expensive.
I mean, this whole thing, this COVID-19, you know, the silver lining in the dark cloud is that this certainly should be a call to action to reform our food supply and our eating habits, because, you know, we take the long term perspective. A lot of people don't care. They say, well, you know, I'm going to burn the candle and worry about whether I'm going to get heart disease or cancer. Long term, especially younger people, they feel they're immortal. But, you know, with a pandemic killing hundreds of thousands of people, and if there is indeed some plausible linkage to the food you eat, I think it's going to really be a teachable moment that's going to bring the message home.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I think that you know, I do hope there are some silver linings in this pandemic, because there are enough black linings that. But I do think now more than ever, people are talking about food in a new way. And I think the microbiome has got something to do with it. I think expert opinion is turning a corner. I don't know if you've noticed that, but the dogma about fats and calories amongst the US experts, you know, is starting to crack up, and there is no longer really consensus on most of these things that are still being touted up by the government as the, you know, the way to eat. So I think we are on the verge of really changing something. And I think it's going to probably be a grassroots movement rather than a top-down government mm-hmm. movement.
Consumer-driven, but yeah.
I think it will be. And I think people will start, voting with their feet and eating with their, for their microbes and demanding better education about not only about what foods to eat, but also how to cook, insisting that every house actually has an oven and, we get rid of some of these food deserts and things. It is a major, major problem. But if people see that, the cost of not doing it is treating obesity, diabetes, and now all these COVID immune problems, then maybe there might be an economic argument just on top of that.
Indeed. Well, I think the popularity of your books, including the latest one, Spoon Fed, Why Almost Everything We've Been Told About Food Is Wrong, as well as the popularity of this Intelligent Medicine podcast, evinces a hunger on the part of people for reliable information. I also want to highlight Zoe, which is a place that you can go to for a fascinating evaluation of your personalized nutrition, shall we say, predilections, things that might fit your biochemical composition and your genetic situation as well as your microbiome status. And once again, give us the heads up on that, please.
Yeah, so go to the website joinzoe.com and you can eat and sign up for a home kit where you get a glucose monitor, you get you can test your own blood lipids after meals, and you get to test your full whole sequence of your gut microbes. And this all gets put together into an app that you can then choose yourself your foods. No one tells you what to eat or not. You are basically just discovering for yourself what the best foods are for you to eat. And you discover what your body really wants. So it's all part of a giant research experiment where we share the results. So every 1,000 more people we get, the more precise details we get about each meal and how good or bad it is for individuals. So I think it can be life-changing just to understand how everyone reacts differently to food.
Well, it's a spectacular effort, and congratulations. I think it's really the wave of the future in terms of personalized medicine. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Spector, for joining us from the UK, and I hope that the situation over there resolves as soon as possible. Thanks for your work as well on that front.
It's been my pleasure. If anyone wants to follow me for the COVID stuff, it's Twitter. My Twitter handle is Tim Spector, or obviously Instagram, where most of the nutrition stuff is. I'm also there as well. But I think we're all in this together to spread the word about educating people about better nutrition.
Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. As an Intelligent Medicine listener, you know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. But vetting your sources and tracking down the exact products you need can be a hassle. That's why I'm inviting you to browse my online supplement dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. We stock only the highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements I prescribe to my patients and take myself. My specially curated professional-grade supplements are fulfilled via the FullScript network. FullScript is the safest and most convenient way to purchase my medical-grade supplements. Buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant, and offers world-class support. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to sign up for your free FullScript account. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com.